dispensers of smuggled goods both in Kent and London. In the metropolis, it was gentlemen's clubs and a selection of the higher-class bagnios of the type Durley liked to frequent. Places of entertainment that used food and music to cover for what most saw as their core activity, the provision of young and pretty female companionship. The business also supplied selective London taverns where the customers possessed the right degree of discretion, like molly houses, a habit forced on them by the nature of their clientele. Private individuals abounded, some members of the legislature, added to which there were aristocrats aplenty. Rich men could be just as concerned with saving money as the poor. I often wonder what such people would say if they knew their names were listed in our accounts, Uncle. That was accompanied by a braying laugh. We could dun them for a fortune to keep it secret. Durley, as he cut into the breast of the duck which had followed the soup, could not avoid a frown. At the same time, he was wondering if treating a nephew, one in possession of a light head, to a couple of bumpers of champagne had been a good idea. Well, into the wine on the table now, he was talking as if he wanted to address the entire room. The response was hushed.
I share the notion they would be displeased, Henry. I balk at blackmail. And can I ask that you lower your voice?
Judging by Henry's expression, this was taken as absurd, and it could be said he had a point. Mrs. Gould's dining room was full and noisy with conversation, backed up by the playing of a harpsichord. True, there were other diners close by, but he guessed them to be engaged in their own concerns, not those of their neighbours. The pretty girls, in fetching garments and expressing encouraging smiles, moved between the tables, playing at being hostesses, were not eavesdropping. They were encouraging the clients to spend money, and no doubt lining up possible customers for a high-priced and subsequent frolic.
I advise you to employ the kind of care I never failed to observe, Henry,
came as an addition, as well as portentous with gravity.
Do I have to remind you of the nature of our affairs?
Henry, nose in the air, cast his eyes around the room with an air of disdain.
I dare say we are surrounded by all sorts of chicanery. I would wager if you scratched beneath the silk garments of our fellow diners, you would find all sorts of mischief.
Mischief does not compare. There are those who would wish to curtail what we do, and such creatures do not advertise themselves, nor would I have a clue as to the extent of any knowledge they possess. They could be sitting at the next board and you'd never know. Might I remind you that the penalty is likely the gibbet?
Henry, emptying his glass again, responded with what for him was close to levity. Can we not rely on your famed legal prowess to confound such a fate? Every report tells me you're a tiger at the bar, feared by the bench. Durley was wondering at how the conversation had wandered, but it was best to indulge Henry with an answer, albeit one tinged with humour.
It is a lawyer's principle to avoid, wherever possible, and whatever the case, ending up in court.
Is that not where fame is generated?
No, Henry, it is where both reputation and liberty for a client, as well as his advocate, can be too easily lost. Much better to settle matters before the need to stand before a judge and jury.
Henry was tempted to name some of the judges with whom Durley traded, but he decided against it, given the previous rebuke. In the gap, Durley, who'd gone back to his duck, changed the subject to one more germane.
You said you were going to outline to me some other matters, were you not?
Ah, yes. Elizabeth's plantations.
She seems set on disposing of them, as I have told you. Fallen for the Wilberforce claptrap about slavery, of course.
It was with a smug air, somewhat added to by the consumption of wine, that Henry responded,
"The matter is no longer hers to decide."
That stopped the cutlery. as Durley looked at him, deeply curious. Suddenly, slightly ill at ease, Henry picked up his goblet again and drank deeply. If he had mentally rehearsed this conversation, the actuality was harder than the realization. Taking a deep breath, he then launched into a filleted explanation of what had happened to alter matters, as well as what needed to be done legally to finalize arrangements.
"Am I allowed to say that this alliance seems rather rushed? Elizabeth gave me no inkling of any impending nuptials in her correspondence."
"She can be impetuous, Uncle, take my word on it."
That stated, the goblet was used once more to hide continued unease, caused not by the lies he was telling, but by the look he was getting from across the table.
"I would accede to the word forceful, Henry, but I have never, in my dealings with Elizabeth, found her to be reckless. And what is she doing, getting wed when she is still supposed to be, what's the expression, culled from Hindi, in purdah?"
"She quite lost her wits for this Spafford fella," Henry exclaimed, so loud that heads turned at the next table. A gesture from Durley ensured the continuance was toned down to a near whisper. "Handsome Gove, and one who could charm the birds from the trees. You do not know Elizabeth as I do, being something of an outsider in the family."
It was not the right thing to say. Durley was such a rare visitor to Cottington, he was almost invisible as a Tulkington. It could be counted on the fingers of one hand the number of times he'd come down to East Kent since the death of Acton. That included the funeral, and of course Elizabeth's wedding to Stephen Langridge. On both occasions, a normally highly sociable creature had felt it necessary to retire into the background and avoid staying around after the ceremonies were over. Durley might be a master of obfuscation, a necessity of his profession, but there was no hiding the way the illusion had upset him. The matter of his birth was never raised, so his nephew could not know, first, how acutely embarrassed he was by his bastardy, and second, how mention of it was avoided by his family in their own bailiwick. Never alluded to in London, not that most people would have cared. They knew it led to pointed fingers or eye avoidance in a rural and more puritanical setting. A suspicion his status was known throughout the locality rendered him a rare caller. Henry was too insensitive a soul to consider the possibility there might be a degree of jealousy in the way he was regarded. He would not have noticed it anyway, that being too well concealed. But for an accident of birth, it would have been Durley who'd inherited what Henry held by right. It rankled that he, much older, and he was sure, 10 times wiser, was obliged to treat his nephew with a degree of respect, which in his eyes, Henry often failed to warrant. If the mask slipped, it was soon back in place, as was the interest in the revelation.
"Well, if Elizabeth has succumbed to this fellow's charms and married him, what legal matters require to be settled? As her husband, he acquires her property by statute. There is no entail, unless Stephen Langridge had one drawn up in Jamaica. I do think, if he had, Elizabeth would have told me in her letters."
Having crossed the first hurdle, Henry felt on safer ground, so he responded with confidence. "Charming he might be, but Harry Spafford openly admits to having no head for business. He finds the idea of the West Indies daunting and the management of plantations utterly unnerving. He has expressed a wish to pass that to me."
"I deduce from what you say there's going to be no sale."
"Perish the thought." The main dishes had gone to be replaced by a bowl of fruit, another of nuts, as well as a decanter of port and a syllabub, which was tasted before Henry replied.
"Let us say she has seen sense. Or perhaps her Harry has persuaded her that talk of freeing slaves is poppycock. I mentioned his silver tongue, did I not?"
"But surely," Durley replied, clearly mystified, "if they are to be retained, it would be best if Elizabeth and this Spafford fellow went back out to Jamaica.
much easier to manage close at hand than from across the ocean, even for one shy of the responsibility. And I'm sure poor Stephen, who was equally not keen on the task, managed it well, for he inherited a competent overseer. I sought to persuade Spafford, of course, but the gesture of futility, waving hands, was supposed to settle matters, but there was concern across the board.
So, what are you asking of me?
Is it not obvious that you draw up a document by which Spafford can transfer oversight to me, which I will get him to sign?
It will require to be witnessed.
Which Elizabeth can do, surely.
Better another, Henry. A wife can cause complications in that area. I have known them to claim duress, and the courts can be sympathetic.
Though Henry didn't know it, the note of exasperation with which he responded was an error. So accustomed to getting his own way, he had allowed to atrophy the antennae which would have sensed his uncle's discomfort. A highly regarded barrister, Durley had honed skills over the years that could sense dissimulation a mile off, and he was smelling it now. A spoon was dipped into the last of the syllabub, and that was savoured before Durley spoke again.
Why do I have the feeling, Henry? There are things you are not telling me.
I cannot guess what you mean. Came with an arch expression and an injured tone before a glass of port was sunk whole. I am giving you matters as they stand, and I require you oblige me with your help. In seeking to deflect, Henry only made things worse, for unbeknown to him, Durley's hackles were twitching. With anyone else he would have briskly stated his concerns, but, and this seriously rankled, he had to be careful with his nephew. He had learnt long ago he was very sensitive to anything approaching criticism.
Surely, Durley continued, it would have been best to have Elizabeth and her new husband come to see me in person. In company with you, of course, if you so desired. Or at least, she could have written to me and advised of their intentions. I have always had a soft spot for her. It would have been nice to have met this fellow who, you say, has swept her off her feet.
In a perfect world, Uncle Durley, Henry insisted with a note of conceit, partly induced by drink. Everything is possible. I have been asked to do this, and it would please me to be obliged.
Of course, Henry,
was what Durley said. But he was thinking he would write to Elizabeth and ensure what was being asked for accorded with her wishes, an intention dashed by Henry's next demand. I will take it back to Cottington for signature, if you can have the required papers drawn up this afternoon.
I'm not your damned clerk,
was on the tip of Durley's tongue. It stayed there.
That syllabub was rather fine. Help yourself to more port.
As sweet as some of the girls employed here, Uncle, Henry said, looking around the room again and chortling, signalling that to him the matter was closed. I am trying to guess which ones you have sampled, and after such a good lunch I am wondering what to do with my afternoon.
I had in mind that we might look over that investment in St. Marylebone. The construction of the houses you've put money into is well underway.
The yawn was for effect, and it was irritating, as was the salacious grin. Bricks and mortar cannot compare with soft flesh.
Durley Tulkington left Arlington Street alone, hiring a hack to take him back to his chambers. Too mature to allow his anger to fester, he calmly put his mind to what had just occurred, and quickly concluded it did not add up to a consistent whole. Elizabeth was not impetuous, and from what he knew of her, less, he had to admit, than he would have liked, he was sure she cared for the social norms. This meant she would have seen out her term of widowhood. Added to that, it would have been seen as a disgrace, and would have led to social death had she married too soon after the conclusion of the accepted 3 years. Following that, a long period of courtship was mandatory. Accepting there were matters of concern was one thing. Deciding what could be done about it was another problem entirely. Chapter 14. Edward Brazier entered the Three Kings at 2:30 on the clock, to be greeted, as ever, by the lugubrious countenance of the proprietor, Garlick. Not that it stayed that way. With a gimlet eye for profit, plus an overbearing necessity to know the business of other people, the look changed to one of false indifference. The new arrival was not fooled. Garlick, if he did not know already of Brazier's purpose, would surely bend himself to finding out. "Is Mr. Pitt arrived yet?" This demand was made to forestall him, only to realize it was a foolish question. The King's First Minister never went anywhere in these parts without an armed escort. If the man had been here, there would have been 2 musket-bearing soldiers outside. Soon, when he came, they would join Duchy and the others. So Pitt would be safer than ever from the people of Deal.
"He's expected, Your Honour. Expected. But not yet with us."
"I assume he has requested the private room."
"He has. Then I shall wait for him in there."
"Oh, fetch along refreshments, Captain Brazier."
"For which I will pay."
"As you wish, but Mr. Pitt is fond of a particular claret, already decanted."
As he told Garlick to fetch that, he could not help but wonder at its provenance. The quality of the wine in the Three Kings had surprised him when he first arrived in Deal. But he had come to realize in very short order this establishment was not the only one with a superior cellar. Saoirse and the old playhouse were equally blessed, while she had more or less told him they were contraband goods, as were those he had bought from the local vintner. Could it be? The man who so railed against smuggling was able to turn a blind eye as long as his discerning palate was indulged. The private room, once entered, had a table set for 2. It also had a view from the windows over the sloping pebble beach and a busy anchorage, full of merchant vessels, stopping here to take on crew and the final stores necessary for voyages to far-off places. Brazier went to stand by one, looking out, registering the dozens of boats rowing to and fro, carrying humans as cargo as well as said stores, hoys with barrels of meat and others ready to pump water into barrels being knocked up on deck by the ship's cooper. Off the naval yard sat a brand-new 74-gun ship of the line, HMS Bellerophon, in the final stages of fitting out. Having been a sailor since he was no more than a nipper, the sight induced a deep hankering to be off somewhere himself, one which never faded, it being in his blood. It was impossible to explain to those who had never experienced it, the lure of the sea. People wedded to the land saw it as a dangerous and unpredictable element, with demons or giant monsters for the most superstitious, or deadly storms for the more rational, hurricanes which regularly swallowed humans whole and unwitnessed, leaving behind nothing but a mystery which, in time, would fade from memory. It was a setting of hard work and foul conditions, worse when it came to naval service, where to those who did not know the reality, every captain was seen as a cat-wielding tyrant. Like all wild tales, there was an element of truth in it, not least because it was one spread by tars to guy eager listeners over a pot of ale. There were commanders too fond of the cat, though many less than legend had it. Strict discipline was applied aboard a ship of war and accepted by all for a very good reason. No one could sail in safety without it. Missing from the landsman's image was the camaraderie that came from being part of a close-knit company. It was a place where everyone was required to know and be expert at the several tasks they were there to perform, living in close proximity with people of shared values, common humour, and a language particular unto itself. Then came excitement. How to explain the sheer delight of sailing a frigate on a brisk wind with a full set of canvas drawing over a deck, heeling like a pitched roof, perhaps with a ship ahead in the act of being overhauled? What of the prospect of battle, of being part of a fighting whole, trained to and expecting to win, with, at the end of it, a purse full of prize money? If there was much dreaming in there, who would want to live without such?
I find you in a brown study, Captain.
Brazier spun round to face his host, who had opened the door but not yet closed it, an act which carried no sound. Pitt stood framed in the doorway, wearing a smile that could be termed enigmatic, for previous encounters had established he was not boisterous in his humour. He was wearing a powdered wig which tended to make his face appear more rounded than it truly was. But there was no mistaking the air of self-control as well as the acumen emanating from a steady gaze.
I was reflecting on the attraction of a life at sea.
Not one I would rush to share. And is it not true you don't have to look beyond the Goodwin Sands for a reason to keep your feet dry? If I could dredge out the gold and valuables from the hundreds of ships that have foundered there, I could pay off the government debt.
Before Brazier could respond, Garlick appeared behind him.
Brought you the decanter, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Garlick,
Pitt said, standing to one side. You may leave it on the table. What followed was a bit of a comedy. Garlick did as he was asked, but then seemed to hover, his large purple nose twitching as if there was an odour to trace. Pitt's smile went to fulsome as he addressed the proprietor to tell him,
"That will be all for the moment."
It was with an air of disappointment the command was obeyed, Pitt adding as the door was closed,
"I'm often tempted to say, or should I put it as invent something which would set in motion a lively bit of gossip?"
"He's the one to spread it. That's the truth,"
was Brazier's mordant reply. While wondering if both he and Pitt might be dunned for the same decanter, Garlick was a sly cove with his bills.
"I find you well, I trust, Captain."
There was no point in supplying a negative. His present concerns would not be aired at this table, and he was sure Pitt was unaware of them.
"You do? And how do you fare?"
Pitt moved to the decanter to begin to fill two glasses.
"I bless the air, sir, as ever, and the walk from Walmer. After the stench of Whitehall, it clears the brain."
A glass was offered to his guest, and taken, his own raised.
"To sea breezes."
Brazier raised his glass to sip. Pitt's went to his mouth to be emptied, then refilled.
"Did I see some men outside, Captain? Fellows who are by their dress. Sailors?"
"I've had some of my old barge crew join me."
"Commendable. But I'm forced to inquire as to their being armed. Do I take it you anticipate trouble merely from the act of meeting with me?"
That was tricky. The last time he'd seen Pitt was at Walmer Castle in the company of his heavily pregnant sister, Lady Harriet Elliot. Then it was he who had the black eyes, added to a cracked rib on the mend, it being not long after his beating in the lower valley road. His contusions were explained away and dismissed by a fall from a horse. What could he say now that would not be too revealing?
"I found Deal to have elements residing within its boundaries, which make precautions wise. But in reality these are men paid off from the service and in need of employment. As their old commander, I feel it's my duty to provide it."
"Commendable, sir."
Soon saw another empty glass. A knock brought a servant and a tureen of fish soup, so they sat down while bowls were filled, silent until the girl disappeared.
"How is Lady Harriet? Has she come down to Walmer with you once more?"
The face fell.
"You do not know. My dear sister expired following the birth of her child."
Brazier felt as if he could kick himself. It must have been in the journals that came down daily from London, newspapers he'd been too preoccupied to read.
"My condolences. She had a fine spirit."
the child.
A daughter. I fear my brother-in-law will want for recovery. He is distraught.
Sir James Elliot was discussed not as the broken reed Pitt said he had become, but as a leading light of the anti-slavery movement, a close confidant and supporter of William Wilberforce. Lady Harriet had been just as committed to the cause, and it was one Brazier could subscribe to, as would any man who had intercepted and boarded a slaver in the Western Atlantic, leaving him with an image of degradation and human cruelty he could not erase from his mind. Much as the mood had been depressed by the demise of his sister, conversation by its very nature moved on to less unpleasant topics as the various courses and a second decanter of wine were fetched to the table. One subject aired was the behaviour of the male royal offspring, all of King George's sons having, it seemed, a devilment aimed at upsetting their sire, with Pitt getting the backwash.
He has tried cutting off their funds, but of course there are those who will queue up to be in the company of royal blood, and many of them are eager to act as princely bankers.
I take it Prince William is as badly behaved as the rest.
Your good friend was delivered with a wicked expression.
I'm sure he speaks very highly of me,
was Brazier's sardonic response. There was another feeling behind the words, for if he was in want of a ship, a poor opinion in that quarter would be a serious impediment. William was commonly referred to as the Sailor Prince, while his being labelled a martinet was more likely to endear him to Admiralty than shame him. Pitt, on their last meeting, had told Brazier his name was known and not esteemed by William's father, which was worse. His dining companion's face went down to his cheese, but it seemed a ploy to avoid Brazier's eye, given he delivered another poisoned arrow, not that you would know it from his even tone.
Are you aware that HMS Alcide has come back from the Jamaica station?
Really?
Was the word that covered a tightening of the chest.
Paid off and laid up at the Nore.
The head came up to pin Brazier with a direct look, which was met with a contrived air of complete indifference. If that is what showed, it was not what was felt, for he now knew, and it had been a question he had asked himself, why Pitt had invited him to dine. They had only met on two previous occasions and could hardly be said to be friends.
I would have thought the dockyard more likely,
Brazier opined, as though it was a matter of indifference.
She's been in warm waters for a long time, and notwithstanding her copper, the Caribbean worm is an active beast.
It does not concern you more than her hull that there may be rumours flying around.
Having been resident here in Deal for weeks now, I have been rendered immune.
Brazier knew he would have to ask. There was no choice. If stories were spreading of events in Jamaica, they would need to be countered. The way Admiral Hassel had expired was so unusual as to warrant all sorts of theories, and the question asked was a valid one. How had a deadly, venomous snake, on an island that possessed none, got into his quarters to sink its fangs plus its poison into his neck? It had happened while Brazier was at sea, so he could state unequivocally he had nothing with which to reproach himself, except there were words he had used in addressing his junior officers before he weighed, which had occurred after a furious and strident row with his superior in Admiralty House, which surely had been overheard, he having discovered and informed the other ship's captains of Hassel's depredations, saying something of the nature that he deserved to be strung up.
It is telling, Captain, that you do not ask what the rumours might pertain to.
I assume it's the nonsense you alluded to previously. Some rubbish contained in an unsigned and thus anonymous letter of accusation, when you sought to engage me in your crusade against smuggling.
By the Lord, that's the right word for what is required.
when first mooted. It seemed to make sense to Pitt that Brazier help him combat smuggling, on the grounds that he was a captain without a ship, with very little prospect of getting one. That was more certain if you counted the factors working against him, royal disfavor and a fleet being run down, not expanded. William Pitt hinted he was in a position to overcome all these barriers. The point Pitt had made at Walmer Castle was telling. What at one time had been an opportunistic occupation for Deal boatmen was now, if you took the massive and steady losses to the public purse, being conducted on a near-industrial scale. Even as the First Lord of the Treasury, he was at a stand when it came to clapping a stopper on it, for too many in Parliament either didn't care or saw it as beneficial to their own needs. The Navy declined to patrol the Channel, and he had only managed to burn the boats on the Strand previously by begging for a body of soldiers, as he put it, on my damned knees, and they nearly failed to show. The effect of that conflagration had proved negligible. Boats were rebuilt in short order, and they had to be, but in the interim, until they were fully restored in the required numbers, there had been no discernible fall-off in the supply of untaxed goods. His informants told him everything previously available to buy was still being hawked, which led him to conclude there was some secret controlling interest, and that was what he needed to find out. It was not put forward that Brazier should do anything dangerous, but Pitt had picked up, no doubt from Garlick, who was a damned nuisance and eager informant, of his connection to the Tulkingtons, one of the leading local families. He would thus be certain to move in certain circles where a misplaced word or a sharp observation might produce a clue. This followed, could reveal something about the organizing cabal, which Pitt insisted had to exist, since no one man could oversee such depredations. Brazier had not been in the least bit tempted. He knew no one in the locality, if you excluded Betsy and her family. Given he was not on good terms with her brother, the so-called social whirl Pitt referred to was unlikely to materialize. Not that he would have agreed, regardless. Could he be tempted now, when he was in possession of the kind of information Pitt had hoped he would come across? Under heavy scrutiny, his mind was spinning. Was it just that anonymous missive he had referred to before, which landed in England with his own dispatch, in which doubts had been raised about the manner in which Hassel had died, probably naming it as a foul murder, not a tragic accident? It would not take too febrile a mind to consider it possible. The Admiral had gone to bed in good health, to be found in the morning by his servant, his face blackened by venom, his expression one of a terrible rictus, and his heart stopped. Again he had to inquire, but it could not be posed as a question. "If you are aware of more nonsense being spread, I would be interested to hear of it." Would it suffice if I say this? Lady Hassel was favoured by a visit from the captain of HMS Alcide. In questioning him, she concluded that all was not as it should be, and has descended on the Admiralty demanding answers.
To what questions?
Pitt shrugged. First, how the snake got into her husband's quarters, one so intent on employing its fangs on a sleeping man. It is falsehood, I am told, that snakes are aggressive creatures. Sir Joseph Banks, whom I mentioned to you previously, insists they are shy, unless in the presence of their young, more inclined to hide than attack. As the world's foremost expert on the natural world, he should know.
I know little of the creatures. I was told it is what the French call a fer de lance, quite common in other parts of the Caribbean, and on several islands within a day's sailing distance of Kingston. As I explained to you before, the plantation slaves import them for their barbaric religious ceremonies. All of which, I made sure, was conveyed to Lady Hassel by the conduit of my brother, Chatham. I must tell you, she does not accept a word of it, and she again questions why her husband was buried at sea with what she sees
as undue haste when he had expressed a definite wish to be brought home to his family plot. I do believe the decision was yours. This was leading to questions Brazier did not want to deal with. Time to nail the purpose.
I cannot but feel you are telling me all this so you can reprise your wish that I become your spy.
My eyes and ears, Captain. In a situation where I am at risk if I merely enter the middle of deal without an armed escort. Ergo, no one will talk to me.
Edward Brazier needed to think. Perhaps Pitt was, albeit inadvertently, offering him a way to confound Henry Tulkington. But what would be the effect on Betsy? She was still, legally, wed to Harry Spafford. Getting her free of that entanglement must take precedence over trying to bring down her brother, which he suspected would not be a simple matter. Best out of it for the present, was his conclusion.
I was about to thank you for dinner, Mr. Pitt, but since I'm about to disappoint you once more, perhaps I should meet the bill.
My invitation means it is my tariff, sir.
Brazier stood to look him right in the eye.
Then I bid you good day.
There he was, as ever, by his hatch with that look in his eye, one which was on the lookout for any snip of information by which he would grease the rumour mill.
Off home, Your Honour.
The grunt of a positive might have been less abrupt if he'd heard Garlick later on in the day boasting he'd had William Pitt eating at his board. Though given his audience of beach householders, he was wont to add his temptation to poison the sod.
"Aye," he said, drawing on his pipe, "entertained that Brazier cove, you know, the Navy feller, as a dip of a morning, and not for the first time. And very friendly they was, too."
Chapter 15. Having found the note long after her old friend had departed, Annabel Colpoys was in a quandary. Roger, too, was no longer present, he having gone off to his farming duties. As she read the tiny writing, so shocking were the words, Annabel wondered if Betsy had been struck with some affliction of the mind. The notion that Henry had deliberately drugged her and put her through a marriage ceremony of which she recalled nothing was simply too outrageous to be seen as true. The plea to deliver it to Edward Brazier with Betsy begging to be rescued also induced mixed emotions. It spoke of an involvement that her husband had expressly forbidden, even if it was a stricture she had previously disobeyed. To help Betsy meet with the man she was intent on marrying while simultaneously humbugging stiff-necked brother Henry had proved too appealing. Roger, whose curiosity rarely rose above the plough and the decanter, proved easy to circumvent. What was being asked for now posited a different order of magnitude. If Betsy was telling the truth, there had been more than a breach of family harmony and an internal dispute. This bordered on a crime and spoke of an involvement that could extend beyond merely acting as a carrier of a message, one more difficult to keep concealed, while discovery would bring retribution. Her husband had gone so far as to mention the horsewhip, if she disobeyed him. Was it worth the risk? When she reflected on his motives, it was impossible not to feel a slight sense of shame. This, reinforced by the sounds from above her head as her trio of children rushed noisily across the wooden floorboards of the schoolroom, until a shout came from their tutor, which also penetrated, for them to get back to their desks. The feeling that her man could not, or would not, stand up for himself was the cause. It had become obvious at some time past that Roger, in dispute with Henry Tulkington over a boundary, had been subjected to a thrashing. It had never been established who was responsible. Indeed, once the contusions had faded, it was not acknowledged as to have taken place at all. He'd been drinking. It had happened, and was put down to an unknown assailant. But Annabel knew Betsy's brother was the source, even if it could not be openly referred to, just by the manner in which Roger's behaviour had altered. Always in something of a passion,
It was in his nature and doubly relevant when fueled by drink. He had abruptly ceased to curse the Tulkington name and his intention to issue a challenge, to become seemingly fearful of having it even pronounced in any negative sense within his own walls. Which begged the question, where was his pride? Where was the protection he owed to her and their children? She had no doubt he knew who had done the deed, and if it was not Henry himself, it had been meted out on his instructions. She could see him now in her mind's eye, in times long past, the streak of melancholy that she, Betsy, and their childhood friends had mercilessly guided. Could cheerless Henry really have turned into a person capable of that of which he stood accused? Reading the note again and Betsy's pleas, she wondered at what was being asked of Brazier.
I know you came as promised. Will you come again?
What did that mean? Did Betsy hope to be rescued by a raid on Cottington Court, or was the request he employ the law against her brother the real purpose? The resolve to act came and went. Yet what finally made Annabel Colpoise decide upon delivery was not the needs of Betsy. She would act for the sake of her own family pride. If the man of the house would not uphold it, then she must. There was another letter on the subject, this one in the act of being written, it being of proper length and containing several carefully drafted queries. Durley Tulkington had to be cautious. He did not know the circumstances of this sudden decision by Elizabeth to wed, only what Henry had imparted, though a recollection of his demand, delivered with confidence and supercilious manner, rendered him apprehensive. Even if it made no sense to his logical and legal mind, he was aware infatuation could make a fool of anyone, leading them to chuck overboard the values by which they lived. It was a thing he had never succumbed to himself, but had seen it too often to lightly dismiss. Thus he had to congratulate his niece, while expressing surprise at her actions. When asking about her new spouse, it was necessary to act as if he was the silver-tongued paragon reported, and one he was looking forward to meeting. This he penned while inquiring if he came with any assets of his own, property or investments, which Durley would be happy, now he was a member of the family, to take care of. Delicacy had to be employed in the matter of the West Indian plantations, an admission that, while he respected her original intentions, he did not necessarily agree with them. That said, he would be happy to comply with her wishes in the matter of disposal. If her new husband desired they should be retained, and that Henry should take over management, that too was a properly exercised right. He would, if it was preferred, offer his own services in that regard. Finally, it was necessary to express a wish the newlyweds should visit London, where it would be his pleasure to entertain them, and to celebrate their nuptials for a second time. Though not stated, he trusted Elizabeth to see it would also provide an opportunity for her to discuss matters with him, free of the interlocution of her brother. The point took him back to the legal document he had drawn up at Henry's request, for there was a clause in there that stipulated the arrangement was only at the discretion of the rightful proprietor. It could be revoked by that person at any time they chose. Instinct, and the mood of Henry just witnessed, told him his nephew would not like it. But he would defend it on the grounds of proper legality. No right could be given away in perpetuity, and it was made plain this was the client's wish. In this case he was acting to protect Elizabeth, should anything untoward happen to this Harry Spafford. If the quill stopped occasionally, it was to reflect on the way he saw the family of which he was a tenuous part. Could he really consider himself as such? If he kept a distance from Cottington Court for his own reasons, he had often been put out by the seemingly reciprocal disinterest. Apart from two occasions already recalled, invitations to visit were non-existent, by which he could only conclude that if he did not wish to be reminded of his bastard status, neither did they. Not that he would have accepted an invite. That was beside the point. It annoyed him never to have been afforded the opportunity to politely decline a request to visit a place of which he had few fond memories. He had enjoyed a fairly happy childhood, running in the streets of Deal with his younger brothers as mischievous as was natural, all of which ceased when the family moved to Cottington Court. His father he recalled as a rough diamond, but also an extremely active and successful runner of contraband. From that had come the funds not only to buy the estate, but to raise it back to what it had once been, a grand manor house and a productive farm. It had also paid for proper schooling, which came with an ever-ready birch, as well as the various attributes seen as necessary to claim to be a gentleman. So it had been goodbye to freedom and innocent fun. What mattered was a good seat on a horse, plus an ability to wield a sword, a smattering of Greek and Latin, added to enough fluency in French to hold a conversation. This rounded off by training in rhetoric. Out went the grabbing of food at will and at any time of the day, proper dinner times were imposed, and bad table manners earned a cuff round the ear. Then there came the need to be at ease with a multitude of servants whose manners seemed better than those who paid them. Not that mere possession of the estate, extensive restoration and the schooling of the next generation had conferred respectability. To begin with, few, if any, of the local gentry had taken to the Tulkingtons as neighbours. But time and money provided the grease that broke down even the most intractable barriers. It had done so for the family, as it had for him in London. Working at arm's length with Acton, he'd set up the systems that made their business secure. Durley had thus profited from a double source of income. Funds put to use in the metropolis to both enhance his standing and to protect the enterprise in which they were engaged. He was a shrewd and successful card player, often up against people who were not, though woefully short on any realization of their incapacities. This meant Durley had, in his files, unredeemed promissory notes meant to cover losses sustained by those against whom he played. Many were people of power, members of both the Houses of Parliament who required a facade of wealth to maintain their dignity, even if it was, in truth, hollow. Never pressing for repayment allowed Durley to apply subtle pressure on those who would struggle to settle, in order to ensure certain matters went his way. As of this moment, and not mentioned to his nephew, he was manoeuvring to have appointed the right kind of person to the sinecure of the riding officer of Kent Customs. The present incumbent was elderly and showing signs of failing health, while Durley was sure William Pitt would be seeking to replace him, should he expire, with someone willing to be active in the office. This was the last thing required for the family enterprise. The post should be filled with someone like the fellow who held it now, disinclined to leave London unless it was to go to his country estates, comfortable only in a carriage so never mounted, and unwilling to pay properly the person he contracted to carry out the duties. The solution might lie, in many cases, if not exclusively, in those promissory notes. There were enough votes in Parliament to stymie Pitt on a matter in which the requirement for personal prosperity would trump any sense of duty to the nation. That was a sentiment, in any case, not much prevalent on the Westminster benches. Pitt was in the business of abolishing sinecures and the monies they earned to ease the burden on the public purse. For those who stood to gain from one of the many that existed, stopping the King's First Minister was both a duty and a financial necessity. A little discreet pressure on a few key votes should ensure the right outcome. The letter to Elizabeth was reread, sanded, folded, and sealed, to be handed over to a clerk to see posted along with a bundle tied with a red ribbon.
"This you're to take to Nerot's Hotel, where my nephew is residing. There should be no need to wait for a reply."
For Annabel Colpoise to go into Lower Deal was far from straightforward. It was necessary to invent an excuse to descend on a place rarely visited, and it could not be done discreetly. Such a visit required the use of the carriage, a vehicle only taken out when going to church or visiting friends. It also involved harnessing two of the better horses, while taking from the stables a groom to act as coachman, as well as a young lad to ride postillion, both clad in decent livery. None of that could be done without Roger finding out. She was relying on disinterest, for her husband was not one to over-inquire when it came to matters domestic. It was she who saw to the employment and overseeing of servants. Not that such was onerous, given those she possessed fulfilled their needs and had been with the Colpoise family for a long time. Annabel made sure the larder and the coal shed were stocked by regular deliveries, and, wine being separate, it was she who wrote up the household accounts, though Roger, once he had examined the sums, disbursed the funds to pay. The commands given, and all arranged, the coach set off on the downward slope to the lower town, with various excuses being tried and tested, until the correct one surfaced. Roger maintained he was not a man to merely lay out the money required to keep the house in provender and candles. He claimed an eagle eye for an error, but an even sharper one for being overcharged. It was a little less than true. Annabel was ever able to supplement her pin money by slight exaggerations in the family budget, presenting Roger with the figures when he had consumed at least a bottle. She took the coach to the fields at the rear of St. George's Church, and, leaving it there, made her way through the graveyard, past a knot of gin-drinking young ruffians, to enter the church by one of the side entrances. A few moments at a pew, hands clasped in prayer, were necessary before she made her way out of the front door. In the bustling street, she had to wait till a gap appeared in the near-endless line of horse-drawn carts, vans, and the odd coach, one big enough to allow the crossing sweeper the chance to clear a path through the dung, also sufficient to cross without getting too much of the horse droppings on the pedestrian foot. Quebec House, she knew, having delivered a note previously, one that showed Brazier a way to discreetly enter the grounds of Cottington Court to meet Betsy without using the main gate. Not that she had met him, merely handing it to his smiling servant, saying who it was from before hurrying away. That, she felt, would not serve now.
"I'm calling in the hope of speaking with Captain Edward Brazier."
"Who should I say is calling, ma'am?" asked Joe Lascelles.
"Mrs. Colpoise. I have reason to hope the name will be known to him."
Seeing quality, Joe nodded. "Will you enter, please?" It was a grateful Annabel who acceded. A public street was no place to stand and wait, which might give unseen eyes a reason to wonder why. Even with her anxieties, she entered the parlour as would anyone of her sex, with an eye for the waxed pine panelling, the quality of the furniture, the drapes and the paintings that filled the walls, deciding it was very much the abode of someone masculine. Likewise judged, when he entered the room, was Brazier. Annabel took in a height that obliged him to duck under the lintel of the door, as well as the build of a man not wanting for physical strength. Black hair tied back in a queue, he was dressed in a white linen shirt which exaggerated what could be described as a saturnine visage. But he did not smile, which told Annabel he was unsure of the nature of the call.
"Mrs. Colpoise, we meet at last. Betsy spoke of you, and I believe I owe to you our ability to share time together."
"Captain, I come to see you on behalf of our mutual friend."
"I had hoped it was so when your name was passed to me."
The fellow who had opened the front door came to hover just enough so his shoulder could be seen by Brazier, which probably prompted the offer of refreshments.
"Forgive me, Captain, but I cannot linger."
The note came out of her hand muffs.
"I bring you this from dear Betsy."
It was taken eagerly. But Brazier paused.
"Do you wish me to read it while you're present?"
"It would please me to inquire on certain things, but I must warn you, there seems little possibility of a reply. This was not passed to me openly, but pressed under a cushion when Betsy came to call.
She can call.
The note will tell you she suspects only in the company of her Aunt Sarah.
Please, sit.
Which she did, as Brazier went to the window where there was more light, to open and read what Betsy had written. Watching him, Annabel saw the broad shoulders sag slightly and the head go forward, to rest on the cold glass of a pane. It is not easy to believe. Brazier came round slowly to reply.
On the contrary, Mrs. Colpoys. But if you say that, it tells me you do not know Henry Tulkington very well.
I've known him for many a year.
Time alone would not reveal his nature.
The note was waved.
This does.
Can it be reversed? Annabel asked, biting her lips as if in fear of his reply.
If it can, I'm at a loss to know how.
He followed that with an explanation of the legal position as explained to him, added to the fact of no one to witness. Betsy intimates in her note that you were present. Is that the case?
I was, but not at the time that mattered.
As he explained, which was of necessity complex, he could see Annabel Colpoys fidgeting and glancing towards the hallway door.
What else to say to her? If Betsy can get a note to you once, she may do so again.
Captain, I'm taking a great risk in calling here.
I must be able to communicate with you in case she does.
The note was waved again.
I also need to reply to this. If to do no more than offer some reassurance, she is not alone. But I sense I have no time to compose anything, even on the off chance it'll get into her hand.
She was on her feet. I'm afraid, as much as I love Betsy, I cannot oblige you by becoming a go-between.
Am I permitted to ask why?
No, Captain, you are not. But you must just accept my word. It is so. Now, if you will forgive me.
Of course. Do you require to be accompanied? I have men here who will do so.
No, an escort might set tongues wagging. Now, I must bid you goodbye, though I admit it was good to put a face to the person Betsy so esteems.
Joe, show the lady out.
As Annabel Colpoys exited Quebec House, Brazier dashed out to the back to where Dutchy, Pedler, and Cocky were sitting throwing dice and either crowing or cursing.
Dutchy. The woman who's just leaving, I'll need her followed. If you move quickly, you'll spot her before she gets to a corner.
His old coxswain moved with a speed that belied his size, as Brazier called after him to tell of the colour of the cloak she was wearing, while ignoring the inquiring looks he was getting from the others. Then he went back into the parlour to drag a chair to the window so he could reread Betsy's words. He took in for the first time that the paper seemed stained, which led him to wonder if the cause was tears. But one thing was certain. He must find a way to communicate with her, and if Annabel Colpoys was reluctant to the point of a downright refusal, she looked like the only conduit available.
Where the devil have you been? I've been going mad here waiting for you.
The look that got was one of irritation from Dutchy Holland.
You said follow the woman, and I did.
Where? To the moon?
To where she resides,
Dutchy snapped.
And given that was well more than a mile away, with me having a trot to keep up with her damn coach, I hope you don't mind if I stopped on the way back for a pot of ale, to ease my thirst.
Chapter 16. John Hawker had laid his plans for Edward Brazier, but had other work to do, and not only in the collection of taxes. With a shipment due, it meant various measures had to be put in place. First, he had to extract some of his men from guarding the Spafford gang to be sent to various places, with an eye being kept out for any unusual activity by the revenue. As they operated out of Dover, any sight of their cutter being prepared for sea would be noted. Better if it was secured to the jetty with no sign of it being manned. The men who crewed it lived locally, so it was known where they ate and drank. Not that they were in any way loved.
Their talk, always loose and of interest, could often warn of any impending movements, while at the same time various souls, the kind who ever seemed to know what was afoot, were pumped for information. Not that the excise being overly keen was a commonplace. If the fellow in charge in Dover was poorly paid, it was even more the case with the six inept underlings he oversaw. As a group, they were distant from Corcoran, the fellow placed in the centre of the county with overall authority. He might provide more men, if information received warranted it, enough to watch over a goodly stretch of the shore. They would also need to be sufficient to take on and capture men who would not surrender lightly. Corcoran was responsible for many miles of coastline, which ran from the shore